Okay, so welcome to More Podcast, Less Process, the Metro podcast, the historical record about the historical record. I am Joshua Ranger with AV Preserve, and I'm here with Jefferson Bailey from Metro.
Hello, Josh.
Hello, Jefferson. How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, I'm ready to go into the archival record.
Okay, good. And today, this is our second edition of this, and today we're speaking about activist archiving and other topics with, with Grace and Yvonne from Witness. Can you introduce yourselves?
Grace Lyle. I've been working at Witness for 10 years as an archivist.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Ng. I'm an archivist at Witness also, and I just had my fourth anniversary at Witness last week.
Yay.
Congratulations.
Good job. So, I guess maybe we should just start with a general kind of thing. Our demographic really leans heavily towards the tweens, and, you know, they may not really be aware of Witness and what it does and Peter Gabriel and kind of the impetus for it. So, I was wondering, maybe you can just talk a little bit about what Witness is.
Okay. Witness is a human rights organization, and the main thing to know about Witness is that we have pioneered the use of video in human rights documentation and advocacy. So we've been around for about 20 years. And we've done that work in a lot of different ways, through partnerships with human rights groups, through training, through creating different tools and resources, and done a lot of videos over the years, sort of to document human rights and do advocacy. So that's it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why do you have an archive?
We have an archive because through these partnerships that we started in the 90s when Witness began, we would partner with human rights groups all over the world, give them cameras, and they would shoot video in order to document or to create productions that would be submitted as evidence or to other decision makers for human rights purposes. And so the collection grew out of that work. So the partners always retain copies of their material, but the video collection started growing at Witness as well. And at a certain point, namely 2003, the realization occurred that, hey, we have to do something with this growing collection of tapes, and because we can't find anything anymore, and there's a lot of stuff here, and it's not organized well enough, and so on and so forth. Pretty typical, and that was really when the formal archive began.
Mm-hmm. So it's really a production-based archive here, companies, in a way?
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, we've not always necessarily done... we worked with a lot of people that have done productions out of house, but we've done a lot of co-productions with human rights groups. And so a big part of our archive was integrating the archival functions into our production workflow. So yeah, that's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And so how does, we're talking to a lot of archivists out there and this is a different kind of thing, the production archive and how you take care of things as you're actually creating them or very soon after, rather than some point of acquisition that much later on. So how does that differ, and what are the challenges there? What are the differences there?
Well, as Grace mentioned, our archive is very actively used. It's not just something we're collecting to preserve, but as soon as something gets into the archive, it's being repurposed in video productions, being put up online, and all sorts of things. I think one of the advantages of working in a production archive is that we are very much in touch with the people who are creating the videos and people who are working with the videos. So that actually makes it easier because we can specify what's required for to get stuff into the archive, like what kind of documentation we need, what kind of information we need from the producers. And the producers can tell us what they need from us, and we can easily deliver that because we're all working within the same system.
Mm-hmm. And how well do they cooperate with you on that?
It's challenging. I mean, I want to hear from Yvonne because she is the person who's been doing this work directly for 4 years. I'll give you my perspective as well, having done it for a long time. It's very challenging, and actually, I have a background where I worked at CNN for years, also in a production archive, and in some ways it was more difficult there, working with your average field producer in American television, mm-hmm. to get them to actually, produce the metadata and document and submit everything and like even understand why it mattered. So I think it's counterintuitive a lot of times when you're creating your own stuff because you have it in your mind and you have your own purpose in mind. So to be thinking long term in terms of like how somebody's going to access or what information they're going to need in the future, or even thinking about structured data, like people aren't really thinking that way. So it definitely requires training and education. I don't think it comes necessarily naturally to most people, I would say. But so a lot of work has gone into and does go into working with creators and Yvonne.
I would say our situation is probably a lot less challenging than broadcast television from what I can tell, because we're not working on those kind of really tight deadlines, mm-hmm. For getting stuff on air. But we certainly have a lot of challenges, logistical challenges. For instance, just getting footage sometimes from the partner to our office in Brooklyn, New York, sometimes is quite challenging. It usually involves, shipping hard drives or witness staff coming back with hard drives of material. But even in those cases where we can get the footage, as Grace mentioned, it's sometimes, because the people producing the videos have so many other things to think about when they're doing their interviews or documenting an event or a human rights violation, they often don't take the time, let's say, to fill out a form or provide all the information that we want in order to make the video accessible. So, some of the things that we try to do is, really simple things, like we provide templates for logging and transcription or forms that people can fill out with like basic information like the name of the videographer or the date. And that has, a lot of partners have used that. Also we're fortunate that the partners that we've worked with, work very closely with our program staff. So often I can get information directly from witness staff when they come back to the office. So there's usually some kind of an interview process when the footage is being submitted to the archive.
My question would, I guess there's a lot of confidentiality issues, and I mean, you mentioned it's very access oriented and immediate use once it enters the archive. So what are, I guess, some of the challenges, or how do you work with content creators to ensure like security of content in transfer, but also security of, personal information and that sort of thing? Because that's not something, I guess most archives just deal with that by, putting a hold on use or donor restrictions and making things, accessible only after the death of, right. or long after, in some cases, the death of people in the files. But obviously that's not like doable in your situation. So
it's very part and parcel of just human rights documentation and this type of work. So there's, but it's interesting because you really have to make sure that any restrictions for reasons of security get transferred along, because we've had experiences where there were some tapes sitting in, like again, in the old days when we were you know, I mean, we still tape have tapes, but
in the old tape-based days.
In the old tape-based days, we would, and finding out later where there would be no indication or documentation that this was like security restricted material, and sometimes it would, because maybe the person documenting didn't realize it was going to end up in an archive, or so just making sure that sort of chain of information is really, and that's sort of part of what we put in place, so that there are really clear understandings on the part of the creators that they have to provide this information at the shot level, really. And what kind of information, I mean, what kind of restrictions. So for example, you know, we have interviews where the person doesn't want their name used, but they don't mind their face being used, or where they need to be completely obscured visually, but you can still use the video, or where the tape is only being used for a particular purpose and is embargoed and so forth. So there are a lot of different ways to restrict material, and really what we've tried to do as much as possible is, you know, make sure that the database, you know, the way that we catalog the material in the database is, you know, is very, that we have those structures in place for, you know, security restrictions. And then we also, when at the point of access, somebody comes to us. So, I mean, you can talk about that a little bit, Yvonne, but there's another process where we make sure that, you know, we've consulted with folks.
Yeah, to add to what Grace was saying, when we train people to shoot interviews or to film, we train on this process that we call informed consent, where the interviewer gets, you know, verbal or written consent from whoever, the interviewee, you know, as to whether whether their face can be used, whether their name can be used, whether their voice can be used, and make sure that the interviewee really understands how the video could be used, and could possibly be used by a third party in a way that they might not have consented to. I mean, especially, you know, now that we're beyond the sort of tape world where, you know, something can get uploaded for a particular reason, but then somebody else can take it and use it in other ways. You just have to make sure that the person understands that that could happen, even if we hope that it doesn't happen. So hopefully we get that documentation when we get the footage and it goes into the archive, and we note that in our cataloging database. So, you know, if we get an access request, we're able to refer back to that and you know, restrict usage based on that.
But even sometimes I think there are requests where we know something might be sensitive, and we'll go to the staff person, like the program manager who has that relationship with that NGO, or back to the partner directly to just say, is it really okay to, I mean, sometimes it's obvious that it's okay. And sometimes it's really a question about the use that's going to be made of it. And so there's kind of a consultation, like, just to make sure they're really comfortable with it.
Yeah, and especially, you know, when a lot of time has passed. I mean, for instance, I can tell you about, we did a production back in the mid-90s where it involved a lot of, like, hidden camera footage and, you know, somebody from sort of inside this world of the trafficking world, you know, was very candid and spoke it about what happened and what was going on in that world. And at the time, she had signed a consent form, so we had a written signed consent form. But, you know, fast forward to 2013, and we have this footage now digitized from the tape, and we're about to send it to our preservation repository at the University of Texas, where they will be putting copies of that footage online for scholarly use. So, you know, back in the mid-90s, when this person signed this consent form, there's no way she could have known that was a possibility. So there's no way that she consented to the footage being, you know, freely available. But so we went back to the producer and asked for consent again. And it turned out, in fact, that we did have to restrict that footage, even though we had the signed consent form. So it's always about, you know, ensuring the safety and the security of people first. That's always our priority over, you know, providing access to the video.
Yeah. So you mentioned the partnership with UT, and that's the Human Rights Documentation Institute. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So it's the Human Rights Documentation Initiative at the University of Texas Libraries. And we've officially been partners since about 2011. And basically, first of all, the HRDI is it's a relatively new endeavor at University of Texas, but really, really interesting because they are approaching collecting human rights material in a little bit of a different way than traditional academic libraries, and very much in line with how Witness has worked, which is more along a partnership model. So they're working with different collections and organizations, human rights organizations around the world, but not just acquiring the material, also doing training and making sure that the digital materials reside at the source, and, you know, so that it's very much a partnership, not an outright acquisition. So the basis of our partnership is that we are depositing, we're still doing the digitization of most of our footage, our tape, but depositing masters for long-term preservation there, as well as access through through the web, and specifically for, you know, for use by their educational community and scholars and so forth. So it's a pretty cool project, and we're making progress, you know, one collection at a time. So,
yeah, getting somebody else to do long-term preservation is always ideal, really.
Well, I mean, and our approach was that we feel like we do a pretty good job, but we're a 30-person nonprofit based in Brooklyn, not a major research institution, and so that made a lot of sense. But also the access, because our mission is really, you know, it's really outside Witness's mission to focus on sort of research communities, but we feel that's important. Like, this material is very important for those communities, and so having University of Texas sort of fulfill that that role as well, I think, is just a great thing. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely. I tend to be seeing that a lot more, and also in our work, thinking along those lines too. Like, you know, where are the points where you can find the partnerships, and, you know, how can you distribute the responsibility for stuff? If mm-hmm. we're telling people you have to have at least two copies of this, and are you going to make them maintain two servers? You know,
yeah.
Start having all this digital storage space as well as the tapes and everything that they have. Like, you know, trying to get that out there, but also, yeah, the access portion of it. Some organizations just are not set up for that. And,
yeah,
but for me, it's interesting to see how a lot of these large organizations are also still struggling with how to preserve and provide access to audiovisual materials. I mean, you know, we have our challenges, but these large, well-funded institutions are still figuring it out as well.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Yeah. So you're actively in the process of digitizing that tape collection now, is that right? It's still going on? Are you done with it? Or
We're doing as much as we can, but we don't have funding right now to do any like major digitization. I wish we did. We would like to resume that on a. Especially because obviously the material is just getting older. So it is happening, but it's not sort of a constant ongoing.
Yeah, I would say that we sort of digitize on demand when it's needed for production purposes. We don't really have like a an ongoing digitization, you know, project separate from that. So, you know, because we're dealing with new stuff coming in, and that's sort of the priority. And when the older stuff is needed, that's when we digitize it.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do with your tapes once you digitize them?
We put them back in the vault.
we have an on-site climate controlled vault, which is a little bit temperamental sometimes. We constantly have HVAC people coming in. It seems like every other week, but you know, mostly they're kept in pretty good condition. So we haven't had too many problems with the tapes.
Yeah.
But there is, like you were mentioning, there is sort of like a looming, you know, deadline when all of the stuff has to be digitized. So I'm not sure how we're going to deal with that. We have thousands of tapes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I wanted to get, you were talking about some things you've been doing. Witness has done a lot. It's really, you know, built up, it's pioneered this use of video. I guess I have two questions here, so I'll start with one. So why video? Like what's the value there? What does that add to what you guys are doing?
Yeah. For Witness?
Yeah, for Witness, yeah.
Well, video, I mean, how Witness started was really when in the late 80s, people were starting to, I mean, camcorders were new, and Peter Gabriel, you mentioned earlier. So I'll bring him in
Josh
now.
Josh is always mentioning Peter Gabriel. It's crazy.
I'm kind of obsessed.
Who's a very innovative and really interesting guy with a lot of like projects, and he's very techie and stuff like that. Anyway, he had a camera. He was touring for Amnesty International, and he had this idea that, so he was actually videotaping and meeting people, and he had this idea that if some of these activists had a camera with them, how powerful could that be? So that was kind of the beginning of the idea. And then a few years later, 1993, was the Rodney King incident, and that was sort of like the moment when it gelled for other people as well, like, oh, yeah. Just bystanders even having a camera and you know, the power of documentation. So that was how it started, but it was really the idea that, you know, it created a whole different level of documentation of human rights abuses. And in traditional sort of human rights advocacy, I mean, it was not really a commonly used tool. So for example, with submissions to legal bodies or as evidence or, you know, different, there's not really been a lot of precedent for that. So even that kind of use was, you know, it feels like video is so ubiquitous now, but it really wasn't for a long time. And it's in a lot of legal jurisdictions, it's really just starting to even be grappled with in terms of like rules of evidence and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so Witness was really the first organization there that saw that the power of video as an adjunct to or a complement to other sort of more traditional research, reporting and documentation and legal mechanisms. You know, so it's only one part of human rights advocacy, but it has a particular power.
I mean, I think what something that's interesting is, you know, 20 years ago, or I mean, less than, you know, even more recently than that, I mean, video was seen as like a potentially powerful storytelling tool, or, you know, visual documentation tool. And now with digital video, I think, you know, now we can start thinking about video as a, you know, as data and as a powerful tool for, you know, that you can use to like to analyze as data. That use could be just as powerful as the visual aspect of video, I think.
And metadata.
always metadata.
Don't forget the metadata.
So, you know, Witness has been very innovative in that, in that way, but also, you know, you've been talking about some of these things where, you know, you've been creating new means of taking care of this stuff, or, you know, doing training and working on things and coming up with these challenges that you have to solve. You know, you have an issue, like issues with, you know, the documentation thing, or, you know, whether you know, if you can't show somebody or you have to change your voice. And so, you know, there's been a lot of stuff that Witness has had to do to develop those resources, develop ways of doing that. And I guess some inside, I just know.
he just
I should,
knows.
I just know. No, I guess I should be asking you this, but I'm talking because make you talk about it. But that's my train of thought. Yes.
No. So you've developed a lot of resources for the community to use, you know, prior to their creation or delivery of material to you. I think we both know what these are already.
Yes.
So we're trying to frame this in a way that you can talk about them that's as if good. We don't already know about them.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm doing, Jefferson.
But now is your opportunity. So tell us about some of the resources you have created, both in the past and ones that might have been recently released.
Yeah. Is that a leading question?
It is.
We were talking earlier about Obscura. Is that the right
thing? Yeah. Like, I mean, do you want to hear about Witness overall or specifically about the archive?
I think the tip sheets, before the guide came out, I think the tip sheets were really useful, and we used to point mm-hmm. people to them mm-hmm. a lot, so that's great. I mean, the Obscura Informa.
That's what I was trying to say. I was trying to kiss your ass and talk about like how instrumental the archives have actually been in that development as well. Like,
right.
it's not just Witness that's doing this. It's, you know, the archives have actually been a major part of developing resources that are a big part of what Witness does. So I guess, you know, interested in like what the archive's role in that and what you guys have been working on.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's really evolved. I mean, I think because I do think that historically people have thought of the archive as this separate after the fact thing. And we've, you know, all along as archivists been pushing against that idea that it's, you know, that it needs to be part and parcel of creation, like you started the period of creation or before. So that's very part and parcel of thinking in production art, in terms of production archives. So it's been very much an evolution organizationally to really have that integration, because, you know, it's just a difference of time span, really, right? You know, the material, like, it starts at this particular, you have to create it, then you do something with it, you distribute it, but it's really just over time. But ultimately, you have to think about the future of that material. So it's really been an evolution to start creating and specific materials, but I think also then to just create the sensibility where archiving is really integrated into the whole video advocacy, like, mindset. Like, don't create this footage and think it's so important if you're not going to think about how you're going to take care of it.
Right.
What is going to happen in the future? What do you be intentional about it? And that's really important. And so, yeah, so do you want to talk about?
Well, just to follow up on that, more than one person in the last little while has told me, like, a non-archivist people have said, like, this is, like, really, like, archiving has really come into the moment. Like, it's really, like, a hot topic among non-archivists now. And I think
I've been a big part of that.
Yeah. It's right behind curation. I don't know if we've caught curation yet, but we're getting there.
Yeah. But, no, the reason why this is, I think, is because, I mean, now it's, like, this unavoidable problem. Like, people just have these huge collections, and you can't avoid, you know, the archiving issue anymore. I mean, it's like it's there, and you can't use your stuff until you figure it out. Like, you.
Well, it's digital. I mean, I think that's the critical thing, that whether you're an individual or an organization or a human rights defender, when you had a pile of tapes, you could have the illusion, and we all know that It was an illusion.
She looks.
You had the
Prince.
Illusion that if you just like put them in the, you know, wherever, you'll deal with them later. You'll figure it all out, and they'll be there. But I think with digital, it's people have had this realization because it's happening in real time, that they can't find things, that stuff is getting, you know, things are getting deleted, things are going wrong, things are, you know, they're experiencing, and because of the quantity. And that shift from tape to digital has really exactly created that, you know, what Yvonne is describing. And it's like this aha moment for so many of the people that we deal with who are suddenly like, this is so important now. And we're like, finally, what have we been saying all these years? It's really, you know, the problem set in some ways is very similar, but it's people have to deal with it themselves, so.
Which sort of leads into your question, your initial question or
whatever
prompting about resources. In that, you know, everyday people have to deal with this archiving problem now. And, you know, activists who are shooting video who, you know, never had to think about archiving before. And so the resources that we create have to reach that audience. So it has to, you know, the resources have to be very accessible, easy to understand, non-specialized language, like, you know, and, you know, aimed at people who might not have all these special tools and resources available. So just last week, we launched a website called The Activist Guide to Archiving Video, which is aimed at activists, media collectives, small organizations like ours that may or may not have archivists, to walk them through the video archiving process in a really accessible way. So we've just launched the guide in English, and on Monday, August the 5th, we're going to be launching the Arabic site, and on August 19th, we're going to be launching the Spanish site, so it'll be available in three languages.
Nice. Can you tell us the URL? For the listeners out there,
you can visit the site at archiveguide.witness.org.
And what were some of, I mean, out of my personal curiosity, and I think probably everyone's curiosity, what were some of the like difficulties or challenges of, you know, distilling down archival principles into simplified language and practical tips and that sort of thing?
It's inherently difficult.
Yes, it is.
I mean, there's no question, and you know, we went through many iterations, and we worked with others and got a lot of feedback to try and to really think through what the, you know, because it's both the concepts and the language, but it's also the structure of a website that you have to think through how people are going to access it. And it's challenging. I mean, just the archiving language generally is hard to make accessible to people. Accessible and meaningful, both. Not too oversimplified. Because you can oversimplify and then it doesn't really help you either.
Right.
So finding that kind of exact balance of, you know, simple enough to reach people, but not too simple so that it's not really useful. But I think it was a long process with you know, a lot of brainstorming and discussion.
A lot of editing.
A lot of editing, a lot of great feedback. And, you know, it was much a process.
It's quite extensive even beyond the guidance. There's a glossary and key concepts.
So,
there's a lot of information in there that must have been difficult to package in a way that was easy for people.
Well, we just tried to think it, like put ourselves in the mindset of someone. We drew on the experience of ourselves and our peers working at Witness, working with different human rights defenders and activists and other peers in other organizations who are sort of grappling with the same sorts of things. And we looked to other, you know, and we certainly looked to other like examples of maybe not archiving per se, but other types of things to just draw on, like thinking about that. But
yeah, what is the response been like? I realize it hasn't been out too long, but I mean, it's gotten a lot of tweets, definitely from people that are not, you know, the typical archives crowd. So it seems to have gotten a lot of traction so far.
Yeah, I mean, the initial response has been great. But, you know, like the information in there, and, you know, it will take some time for people to absorb and to actually, you know, integrate into the way they work. So I guess time will tell, and we hope to get feedback from people who are actually using it. And you know, we'll, it's finished and it's out, but, you know, we plan to keep on updating it, to keep it fresh and make sure it contains all the information that people need.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be very important, is like our next, now that we've launched or mostly launched, really making sure it gets to people that can use it in a way that they can use it, and then really evaluating how it's been most useful.
Yeah, because really you won't know until you put it out there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so that's going to be the real test. Is
people
is
start sending you their 16 millimeter and this doesn't fit in your guide. What do I do?
Hopefully. Hopefully it's you know,
too
we
confusing
made it clear.
Going back to film.
Yeah. Well, you know, inevitably it won't be for everybody, but if we can reach a core set of people who can really use it, that's really what we're after, like filling a need that isn't, you know, being met elsewhere, basically.
Yeah, and I feel like there's new tools being developed constantly these days. So, you know, in the guide, we have these little boxes where we highlight the tools that people can use to do the things that we're telling them they should do. And a lot of times in this current release of the guide, there are tools that are require a bit more advanced know-how. But I hope that at some point we'll be able to supplement those with tools that are, you know, have nice user interfaces and that are easy to use.
So, and I guess that brings up a good question that I have, if I can pick on you guys, about who this is for. So it's the activist guide for video archiving.
The name took a long time,
yeah,
too.
Name is always the hardest part.
Yeah. It was very,
In the end, we went back with what we started with.
Yeah. So,
what were some of the ones that you didn't use, just out of curiosity?
We had some really crazy, like, out there ones.
Yeah, we had, well, Archive It was popular. It's taken.
Yes,
we know.
My favorite one that was suggested by one of our coworkers was Stop the Takedown Hurt! Exclamation mark. That was my favorite.
We had a contest, and we got some very interesting but unusable, unfortunately.
Well, I guess the question I have is, you know, what is an activist? I mean, is this for, like, aging hippies and college students who don't want to work? Or is it, you know, like, what? You know, what?
Yes. What is, and why not?
You know, what is an activist here? You know, what is this for? And does it have a wider audience as well, you know, beyond that?
I think so. I mean, it's a really good question because, again, this was, you know, just struggling a little bit with this, like, that's always kind of like, who is your audience and is it going to be really useful for them? But I think to some extent it, you know, it's anybody who's really got a video collection or collecting video, aggregating video, curating video, individual group. I mean, what we've seen so much of in the past few years with the Arab Spring and Syria and Occupy and so many other, or a lot of election monitoring, like in Russia and now in Zimbabwe. There's, because of smartphones and mobile devices, there's so much documentation that's just kind of spontaneous, it's ad hoc, but sometimes those things turn into something that is more intentional and deliberate. So media collectives sort of springing up out of these contexts. So that's kind of like might be an entry point for some activists, like, oh, we have a collection and now we want to actually do stuff with it. We want to get to news media. We want to think about having a you know, thinking about it for evidence. So that's like one example. But it's really anybody in that realm. We do intend for it to be for anybody that will find managing, you know, needs help with digital video, basically, I would say, activist or no. But it has a little bit of it has a human rights and activist orientation because it deals with security issues, it deals with evidence and other things that are particularly apropos of those situations.
Okay, I'll accept that, I guess. and so it is more geared towards digital video.
Yeah, it's entirely
it's only digital video.
That's too bad.
All those people shooting U-matics.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's another project entirely.
It is.
We could get funding and, like, you know, or someone else could take that on.
Yeah.
There are a lot of collections out there, but it was not within our scope. Mm-hmm.
No, I was just thinking, like, it's an interesting thing to think about, of like how that could be the same thing kind of done for, because there are lots of video collectives that are, you know, from the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. Like in upstate New York, or collections like the Lesbian Her Story collection, which has aggregated a lot of those types of collections into one place. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of U-matics and half inch open reel video and that kind of thing. And, you know, it needs that same kind of, it's a very different thing because it's not being created now, but it needs that same kind of.
Yeah, you know. I mean, I think our guide is very much geared towards stuff being created now because, you know, there are sections of the guide that are about, like, when you're shooting your video, what you need to do, when you're, like, uploading your video from your camera, what you need to do. So we're really addressing people who are creating the media now as opposed to, you know, collecting stuff from the past.
Mm-hmm. And what challenges are posed by the fact that people are creating it right now, as far as like transferring it to witness, giving it to witness? I mean, you sort of talked about getting hard drives in the mail, but I assume that you collect through other means and you probably get approached a lot with unsolicited material that may or may not be relevant, you know, to your mission, but it seems like a lot of that would also tie into guidance.
I guess the challenge now is that we're not collecting most of the stuff that activists are creating. And that's why we created this guide, because it's not really possible for us or even like a huge institution to collect all of this stuff. People have to take care of it themselves. And, you know, because they want to use it themselves, they do need to keep it themselves. So I guess, I mean, that's the challenge that this guide is trying to address.
So the guide is really for people that we are never going to have a one-on-one relation. Well, I shouldn't say never, but mostly for people that would not have a one-on-one relationship with us for the most part.
Yeah, it's for people who are uploading their videos to YouTube.
So that they can
so they can mash it up with a Peter Gabriel song, perhaps. Yeah.
But so that they have other ways to deal with their video than just putting it on YouTube and thinking that's, like, you know, good enough. So. Mm-hmm.
So it is really for everyone then, to stop people thinking that way. Don't put it on YouTube.
Well, not don't put it on YouTube. Don't put your video on YouTube.
Don't trust it.
Understand what YouTube will and will not do, what YouTube is for, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, you know, and that does, like, come down to a core piece of archival thinking of, you know, like, why it matters to not just stick it somewhere. why you need to do much more with it, or have that forethought, have a mindfulness about, I need to do this way so that this can happen later on down the road. And that's a core thing. Whether it's something that's being produced currently or is an older thing that's been collected, you still need to think about those issues.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about like some of the sort of more technological oriented tools.
Yeah, so it's just, it's one project under the sort of overall name of Secure Smart Cam, which is Witness has partnered with what's called the Guardian Project, which is a group of folks that do technology for like human rights and social good. And so there are two pieces to it. One is called ObscuraCam, which was the ability to blur faces in video that you take with a, and it's all Android. This is, all of these are Android-based, just to be clear up front. There's, it's an app, so it's a suite of apps. Obscura to obscure identity. So again, people doing human rights documentation want to take video of a protest or something going on, but maybe there's somebody in the shot who could be put at risk. So it's within the app itself, it allows you to then actually blur the identity on the video, simply put. And then Informa, which is the other piece of it, InformaCam, is a way to better capture some of the metadata and embed it into the some of the automatically accessible metadata and embed it into the video file and then have a mechanism for uploading and encrypted files to a secure repository. So we're hoping, I think, for release this fall for like the next like version of this. I'm sorry, I'm not more articulate about this, but
that's perfect.
I'm not directly involved with it, but basically, so again, it's all about human rights documentation, but it gets very much into that archival realm. So it's sort of another example where the archiving and like everything else is sort of merging together, because very much how that, you know, those issues have become front and center now that, you know, now with the explosion of sort of digital video and so many video cameras out there on devices.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it ties into the sort of getting into the early stages of the process for archivists for, you know, metadata purposes, yeah. Secured or security restriction purposes, and secure transfer purposes are all things that, you know, generally don't happen at this point of creation or soon after creation. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of stuff that if you don't get that information early on, it's really hard to get later.
Yeah.
But if you have the ability to, let's say, embed the person's name into your video file, it just makes it so much easier.
And it also, and just, sorry, and just to say, because we're looking a lot as an organization at the issue of video as evidence, because it is still a new or sort of it's a kind of a wide open question in a lot of jurisdictions. And now that there's so much video of so much, like, you know, human rights situations, so questions of authentication are just really, really critical. So how do you document, how do you make sure that that metadata is there? How do you better document? How do you, you know, embed the metadata when you can? How do you record chain of custody in a better way? So all of those things that are not really in, they're not like formal criteria in jurisprudence, but the assumption is that with so much video, the more metadata and authenticatable like information you have, you're the more likely your video is going to be admissible as evidence. Like, you know, the most metadata wins, kind of thing. So all those things really go towards that as a, you know, again, with that thinking through that human rights lens. And luckily that also just completely is in sync with what we need as archivists,
yep,
as well.
Right.
And what the NSA needs to track us.
Yeah. Exactly.
We're going to be blurring some of your voice out of this.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, I know. That's funny. Like, the metadata word just, like, suddenly has become it's everywhere, and everybody mm-hmm. is suddenly using it, and it's like, wow. I remember when nobody knew what it meant.
Well, everyone's using it, but I think people still don't know what it means, and it's like kind of has this like scary connotation. So I think
right, you know, but it's just funny. It's like when you read news articles, like. The metadata is the most important thing. I never thought I would read like a mainstream news article that with that sentence in it, you know. So.
So have you seen creative uses of the witness archival material that you weren't necessarily expecting? I mean, because we were talking about evidence, so it's sort of I was curious. Obviously, it's probably used quite often in legal context, but are there other uses you didn't foresee?
I don't know about not foreseeing. I think we've had stuff used in training materials. We've had stuff used in museum exhibits, lots of documentaries, news footage. Not a lot of videos evidence. I mean, there have been some definite uses, but it doesn't happen that often. One feature film.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Highly unusual. And what else?
Well, I mean, it's not so much an unexpected use of archival material, but one thing that always surprises me is seeing like some of the partners that we've worked with over the years, seeing how their videos have, you know, and production skills have progressed like so much. I mean, we have a partner in Cambodia that we've been working with for years and years and years, and they're amazing. They are like the video advocacy, video documentation organization in Cambodia now, and they make amazing creative videos, like constant output, and you know, they're documenting so much of what's going on in that country, and it's like, you know, we still work with them, but they're doing it all on their own. They make really great stuff.
Do you have any dirt on the other human rights organizations? which ones are the worst?
Oh, I hear Human Rights Watch now. I don't know. Yeah, I wish I had some juicy gossip for you. I don't have anything.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We'll make something up and put it in. Okay. Afterwards, Yvonne told us. Anything you want to plug?
Well, like I mentioned before, we have this new activist guide to archiving video out.
Archiveguide.witness.org.
And I imagine the audience for this podcast is primarily going to be library and archives people.
If there is an audience
at all. Yeah. but, I mean, we do want feedback from the archival community as well as the activist community because, I mean, you guys are the specialists with this knowledge, and we would love to know what you think of the resource.
Yeah, and just, I mean, and really the feed, like very specific feedback from like about a particular like approach or like something new that's come out to, is there uses that are being made? Because again, it's directed towards activists, but we also, you know, you want to know if other folks use it as a training resources or use it or know about other uses. So it's again, we want to really hear about practical usage of it. And if so, what was useful? And if not, why not?
Yeah. I mean, the other thing to note about the guide is that we're licensing it using a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, share alike license. So that means that people can repurpose the content. So, you know, even if you're not doing human rights documentation, you can take the information and cut and paste it into your own training resource. And we'd love to hear about it if you do.
Right. And I know that you presented it at the Digital Preservation Conference last week. Any future sort of outreach or conferences or symposiums or anything?
We're planning on it. I don't think we have anything scheduled yet. Although I have a symposium at UCLA in October. We hopefully will be doing something at EMEA that we haven't heard yet. And then as things come up, we'll be trying to, you know, we'll be trying to get into those spaces and places and so forth.
We have a couple of features coming up on the Signal blog, the Library of Congress's right. digital preservation blog.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So,
Oh, Yvonne, I also wanted to ask you, you're involved with the activist archivist group,
yes.
aren't you?
Yes.
So, yeah, I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about that, like what that group is, what they do. And
sure. It's sort of like an informal group of media archivists. We've been around since around the time of the Occupy Wall Street movement, when that sort of started off. We formed sort of around OWS and thinking like what's happening with all of the video that's being shot, like you're seeing all this video documenting police abuse and all this kind of stuff, and we wanted to assist in whatever way was needed with the media group and with the archiving group of OWS. And then from that, we sort of just kept on going and sort of moved on from working with the OWS groups to working with other, local organizations that had, audiovisual archiving needs. So we've done work with Third World Newsreel. Right now we're doing an inventory project with the Josephine Herrick project. So we hope to keep on doing that kind of thing, like just providing, the people power and the archiving know-how to small organizations that need the help. Thanks, okay. guys.
Well, yes, thank you both.
Yeah, thank you for both for coming in and talking to us. So we appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right. And we'll see you at the movies.
That's a wrap.
Put it in the archive.